Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Cheryl Platz, the author of Design Beyond Devices, and we're going to talk about cross-device experiences today. This episode is brought to you by UserList, a lifecycle messaging tool for your SaaS product. At UserList, our mission is to make your founder journey more enjoyable and less overwhelming. That's why we built an email automation tool that does exactly what you need, no more, no less. Manage your users, segment them, and get in touch throughout their journey, all based on their behavior. Try UserList free whenever you're ready at userlist.com. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello, Jane. It is so great to be here.
We're so excited. Well, first and foremost, congrats on your latest book. Before we get started, tell us a bit about yourself and the book and how it was to launch it in December 2020 in the middle of the crazy year.
Thank you so much for the congratulations. And I would say to the audience, you know what? It's not a good hobby to release a book in a pandemic. There are other hobbies that are probably better for your health. I am a user experience designer, as you may expect. My background is interesting. I've worked in a few different industries. It started out in video games, actually worked for 5 years in the video game industry as a game designer and producer. I have worked and do work in enterprise software to this day, currently at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as a principal user experience designer. And I've also worked on consumer hardware. I spent a couple years working on Cortana and Alexa and on the Echo Show and the Echo Look and the core Alexa platform. So you can imagine, and I also spent some time on products like Windows Automotive. So you can imagine that's a whole bunch of different shapes of devices and types of devices and types of places where people use devices. And so it's given me a lot of time to think about, well, for one, the fact that it is the same customer that moves across all of these platforms. But two, particularly my time on Alexa as everything was coming together in those early years and working on the Echo Show, which was one of the first devices that really tried to put a smart speaker together with a screen. Those were really interesting times. And it really made it clear that we needed a unified way to think about how we sort of orchestrate all of the different ways someone might interact with the computer, whether it's voice, whether it's touch, whether it's typing, whether it's visuals, whether it's sound, all of the possibilities. We didn't have a unified way of thinking about that. And when it became clear that like that wasn't really emerging, that was when I approached Rosenfeld and said, like, hey, you know, I've had some thoughts for a couple of years since leaving Amazon, and I think I'd like to bring this to the world. And so that's where Design Beyond Devices came from. And the subtitle, Creating Multimodal Cross-Device Experiences, it's kind of yin and yang. There's the cross-device experiences is talking about the fact that customers are moving between a phone and a desktop and a smart speaker and a car. And all of these things have different capabilities. And so you as a designer or a product manager or someone developing for all of these things have to learn how to adapt to the different capabilities of all these devices and understand why the customer is moving between them. And then the multimodal side is understanding how to work on any one of those individual devices and orchestrating all of the different ways you might interact with that single device. And this particular book is an addition to what you already know. It doesn't necessarily replace the need to understand voice design if you're working on a smart speaker, but it fills a gap, hopefully, for you. And it's also a shift in the way you approach product design. It starts at user experience research, and it gives you a new way of approaching the questions you ask your customers to give you a stronger foundation. It takes you through design ethics, since a lot of the types of work we do at this scale have deeper consequences for our customers and bigger risk of leaving people behind, of exclusion, and then takes you through frameworks and deliverables that you'll need to work on experiences of this complexity. When people outside the industry asked, hey, what's this book about? The way I described it to them, you know, the elevator pitch was, I'm writing this book because I hope it will be the manual for people who want to design experiences like the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek. So, you know, the people on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, there are physical controls, they are talking to the system, there are big holographics that they're interacting with, they're touching screens, they're moving to tablet computers, and they're moving seamlessly between all of those things. But that took a ton of thoughtful design work to unify all of those disparate elements. And I hope that this book can help designers, product managers, developers build the framework you'll need to get there.
That is such an exciting topic. And, you know, it's 2021 and copying and pasting from my iMac to my iPhone still excites me like in the kindergarten, seriously. Right. But I'm pretty sure it's much, much more serious than that. So give us more context. Who should be thinking about that? Let's say there are people who are just building, you know, B2B web applications. Do they even need to think about multiple devices and whatever cross-device experiences that can happen? Or is it more for people who are developing, I don't know, operating systems and solving more global tasks with their software?
Honestly, it really affects everyone. The question is whether you've accepted that it affects you or not yet. And there's two ways that it, you know, and so I think someone who's developing at an operating system level has already kind of accepted. I think they're probably already operating at this level of complexity. So I'm going to focus on the first case you mentioned where it's more B2B or an app level of complexity. And I'm going to talk about two sides to that coin. And the first side of that coin is the customer context side to that coin. Your customers are dealing with a variety of devices that have different capabilities, and their expectations are evolving. And they've become more sophisticated. And there are going to be times where they're just like, you know what, the keyboard on the mobile screen is not appropriate for entering into this field. I'm going to move to the desktop. And so even though you didn't necessarily design your mobile website as a cross-device experience, maybe it's become one because they're moving to desktop. Or, you know, we've seen the reverse for a long time where somebody moved from desktop to mobile because of some time restriction or space restriction that forced them, you know, they had a commute and so they wanted to look at your site on mobile. That's a cross-device experience. And, you know, especially early in mobile, not everybody intentionally built those experiences. And so I think, especially early in my book, the customer research and understanding parts of my book are important to help you understand how deep that problem goes for you. The framework in there that I provide that's inspired by my improv time character, Relationship, Objective, Aware, which abbreviates to CRO, helps you get at kind of what surrounds your customer, what motivates them, and tells you a little bit about when and why someone might be transitioning between devices. And then you can get a better understanding of not just like the one-on-one relationship between your customer and a desktop and the customer and a mobile phone, but like when and why they're going between them, which is so important. Because I think we've fallen into a lot of patterns the last few years, and certainly the products I've worked on have fallen into the same sort of ruts where we just assume the relationship is kind of static. You're staying in the same one-to-one relationship with the device. So I think, you know, one side of the coin is, even if you think it's just like a desktop to person relationship, it's important to kind of question that, especially now that everything has changed in the scope of the pandemic. People are working at home and their needs have changed. Like they've got kids around all the time. Their hands are full. Are they actually using the desktop in the same way? We don't know. And when they go back to the workplace, their needs are going to change too. Is anyone going to want to use whiteboard markers in a world where we're concerned about getting coronavirus from shared spaces? You know, a lot of the assumptions we made about the environments that surrounded our customers are going to change. So I think that side of the coin, understanding customer experience and what's going to motivate them to change between experiences, is really important. But the other side of the coin too is your experience is probably multimodal and cross-device in ways you don't see. When we talk about inclusivity and accessibility, you know, we talk about like screen readers as a way to force a visually dominant experience to go to an audio form of interactivity. That's, you know, that's a form of multimodal experience that you're not controlling, that you probably aren't putting, you know, some companies do put a lot of time into like what that experience looks like, or what doesn't look like, sounds like, which involves intentional choices about information architecture of your HTML, for example. But there's so much more opportunity to include the customers who are sort of forced over to screen readers. Those customers could be better served by smart speakers. And in some cases, if you're offering smart speaker apps, they may be choosing them already, or if they may be choosing the mobile app of your site because the screen reader on the phone is preferable to the one they have on the PC. So there's all kinds of accessibility reasons somebody might be moving between devices or forcing your experience to be multimodal when you didn't design it that way. And there are so many examples in the design world of people accepting a constraint or a challenge like this and sort of rising to it, and the answer to that design challenge serving the whole population. And subtitles on movies being a great example. You know, it was sort of a requirement for people who couldn't hear the audio properly, but, you know, so many people watch with subtitles on now. And so how might you distinguish your product for your entire customer base in ways you don't expect by using multimodality to serve underserved customers better? So I think there's two sides to that coin, even if you don't think that this book applies to you.
Let's take a moment and dive in into the CROW model for capturing customer context, as it seems to be one of the foundations of your method. So tell us more about that.
Sure, I would love to. So I have done in my free time for the past, couple of decades now, professional improvisation, which is a thing you can do. A lot of people get surprised about that. You're like, being professional at making things up? Like, yeah, actually, it doesn't always pay a living wage, but improv theater, I could go on for ages about that, but I know our time is limited. So I'll just say my improv home is Unexpected Productions, a theater in the Pike Place Market in Seattle, which is incidentally the home of the Gum Wall, the second germiest attraction in the world, which has a different connotation now in the coronavirus world. So that'll be interesting once everything goes back to normal. But anyway, I digress. When we step on stage, we have a special challenge because we have paying audiences watching us and we do not have a script. And so we very quickly have to come up with a story compelling enough to keep our audience entertained. And so we use a framework we teach our students, at least at my theater and, you know, to many other sort of theaters with our same sort of philosophy, as a shorthand for what makes a scene compelling, what fills out a context to kind of bring the human brain along. And we use CROW for that. And as I mentioned before, CROW stands for character, relationship, objective, and where. And so character is sort of the intrinsic elements of the person I'm representing on stage. Like, what is their identity? What doesn't change about them very much in their lifetime? What is motivating them in this moment? Like, how do they express themselves to others? And what is their attitude about the things around them? Relationship, you know, how does the person I'm representing relate to everything and everyone around them? You know, are they brothers and sisters with people around them? What is their status relationship with the people around them? Are they higher status or lower status with the people, devices, space around them? Then there's objective, like what's their short-term objective? Are they trying to buy something? Are they trying to prove themselves? Are they trying to get a job done? And what's their long-term objective? You know, are they trying to get a promotion? Are they trying to find true love? Are they trying to have a child? Those things, understanding both short and long-term objectives can be really helpful in understanding why people make decisions, why people choose products, why people prioritize their days in certain ways. And then the where is something that I think we've kind of become rusty on as an industry, because we've been able to assume like offices look in a certain way, and homes, there's a certain set of archetypes for homes. But anyone who's had teleconferences during this experience have seen just how wide the variety of contexts are, even just in simple example of homes. And so where it talks about our environment, you know, what is around our environment? What's at arm's reach? What do I see? What don't I see, but is still around me? What's distracting me? What sounds are there? What other people are around me? And what might I move towards or interact with? You know, that's very, very relevant, particularly when we start talking about more naturalistic user interfaces like smart speakers or gestural interfaces. It was so important working on experiences like Echo to do a lot of storyboarding to show our stakeholders like, hey, you can't assume the customer can see this device because they put it in the corner and they're having dinner. So they're not looking at it. Like, I know we have a screen, but they're not looking at it. So we still need the full audio experience here. And so that framework, it's not like the core techniques you're using for reaching out to your customers change. It's just the nature of the questions you're asking them expand. And you may know the answers to some of these questions. And so there's a set of worksheets, and we're going to share the link with all of you folks, but there's a set of worksheets I've put together to help you as a team do a shared understanding workshop to sort of gather what you already know about your customers and brainstorm sort of how that translates to Crow, and then turn that into an understanding of what open questions still exist, so that you can prioritize your research from there. Because I think even before you get to Crow, having the group just all share the same knowledge about the customer is so important, and so many teams don't even get to that stage. So we're going to share a link. It's a series of worksheets you can use to work through Crow, even if you haven't purchased the book. And I am also doing a workshop on that, launching it for the first time at Interaction 21. But I anticipate there may be other opportunities to take it if you can't join me at the beginning of February. So it is core to the book. And even if you're not ready to go like fully multimodal in your experience, this expansion of your research technique will probably pay dividends. And these worksheets will, and the technique of putting together a shared understanding workshop will probably I use these all the time, these sorts of workshops all the time in my work right now when kicking off projects. It's just so important for a group, cross-functional group of stakeholders.
Take us through how our listeners can create that foundation that you described that can help them later on provide those cross-device experiences. And I'm talking about the next steps that you've mentioned in our pre-recording chat, which is building the activity model and then the interruption model. So tell us more about that part.
Yeah, I'd love to. So let's say you've done customer research, or you've assessed what you already know, and you're ready to take the next step. One thing that we have not done a great job of yet is teach our systems some manners. I'm sure we've all had the experience of typing at a PC or a Mac and being frustrated because a dialogue pops up mid-typing. You know, like maybe you're working on an email and an app opens up that you had tried to open up but took a while to load. And you get frustrated because you're like, hey, I was typing. You didn't need to interrupt mid-sentence. You could have waited a few seconds. You should have known better. Like, it seems so strange that the computer does not understand that me in the middle of a sentence should not be interrupted because it has all the data it needs with my hands on the keyboard and its knowledge of like how long how long there are typically pauses between keystrokes. And so the next step, once you understand your customer, I propose to build something called an activity model, which is a representation of the behaviors of your customer in the real world in a way that's sort of patternized that you can teach to a computer, basically, so that it knows the different sorts of ways your customer is going to behave, so it knows when it's going to be appropriate to interrupt them and how it's going to be appropriate to interact with them in each of those sort of different modes of behavior. And so I talk through the behavior model I proposed for the Alexa system when I was working on Alexa notifications. That's one archetype. Your system may have a different behavioral model, but that representation of human behavior is sort of the etiquette book upon which we build the rest of our system. And, you know, the activities models, the activities in the model that I had put together for Alexa included things like the difference between a sustained activity, which was like playing music, where, you know, the system knew I was doing something with the system, but it was an activity that could be paused. So the cost of interrupting me wasn't huge. Like you can pause the music and come back to it and I don't lose any data. And theoretically, you could also speak over the music. Like that, you know, if I wanted to go back to the beginning of the track, I could. Like there's no loss of data. So it's just kind of chilling in the background. So, and music doesn't, and sustained tasks don't take a lot of my cognitive capacity. So it's okay to interact with me a little bit when music's happening. And, you know, one of the core questions I asked to kind of differentiate these behaviors in my model was how much cognitive load does this behavior take? As compared to something like a live activity, like what we're doing right now, podcasting, like this is all my cognitive load. I can't do anything else. I can't listen to music. I can't write anything down. And if someone interrupts me, I'm going to lose my train of thought and I'm not going to get that back. So it's super inappropriate right now for anyone to interrupt me, for my phone to ring, for my computer to interrupt me. And it should know better. If there's a signal coming in on the microphone, it should know that I am busy. And so that's kind of an example of teaching a system how to work around human behavior. And from there, you can build an interruption model. Because in your head, because we've all been trained to think of the sort of the technology opportunities first, you probably have ideas about a technology you're going to work on or a technology you're already working on. And it probably has interruptions it wants to bring to your customer's attention. And especially in real time, like those, there are times when that's appropriate and there are times when that's less appropriate. And so you can sort of map all of those interruptions against the behaviors you know your customer is going to be engaged in. And you can build an interruption model, like how should the system behave when the customer is doing X? And those could be real time or those could be like emotional like states or behaviors. Like if you're in a situation where you're in more of a removed or long-term situation, like it's more of a server management system, like what the customer is not directly engaged with us, and so they're not logged into the system, how is it appropriate to interact with them versus being logged into the system? Those might be two different behaviors in your model. So building a behavior model and then building an interruption model on top of that are two important steps when you're talking about kind of building these cross-device experiences. Because moving between devices is an interruption, and kind of directing people's attention between devices is an interruption. And sometimes customers interrupt themselves. You know, like if I'm in the middle of playing music and I say the word Alexa, I have interrupted my music task with the word Alexa, which is a wake word, which requires the system to quiet the music so it can hear me. So it's really, really important to understand that whole interaction between customer activities and interruptions. And another thing that's super important to understand is transitions. The element of time in these experiences is something a lot of us weren't trained to handle in our whether you were trained in college or whether you learned on the job, like we've learned these static relationships and maybe we learned how to do flow diagrams if we were lucky, but there's so much complexity in the handoffs between systems or even between like states, like connectivity. Like there's so much between being connected to the internet and not being connected to the internet and what your customer should see between those two states. And so I have a whole chapter just on transitions and how to work with your customer in those crossing states, because a lot of times an experience is made or broken in those transition times. And so the other big piece, the other big framework I want to mention is the spectrum of multimodality. So I've been talking a lot about cross-device experiences and human behavior, but if you're working with a system that has multiple ways of interacting with it, and you probably are, even if you don't use those multiple methods, so a lot of desktops today have voice, have touch, have haptics like typing and mouse input. If you're working with one of those systems, you either consciously or unconsciously are making a decision about where on the spectrum of multimodality your experience is going to land. And so one of the chapters in my book helps you understand how to make a conscious, informed decision about where to place your experience, informed by context. And there's two specific pieces of context that are really helpful in making that decision. One of them is how close the device is to the customer. And one of those is how rich the information is that the customer is going to need. And once you understand those two pieces of information, either in the moment or over the course of the scenario, you can kind of place your experience in one of four quadrants of multimodality. And so we talk through those and what that means for you and your experience. And you might be designing for multiple quadrants, especially if you're working on like a big sort of operating system level experience. But that's another big piece of the book and the process. And then the last half of the book gives you a lot of ways to take these methods, like these frameworks, and translate them into deliverables, take them from idea to prototype or to visualization and to something you could hand off to a development partner and make them real.
Tell us more about that part. How is that represented in the physical world? I mean, the activity model, interaction model, are these like, I don't know, flow diagrams or some guideline principles? What are these?
Well, there are a lot of tables. Tables are an awesome best friend in this book. There are so many tables. If you love tables, this is the book for you. So the activity model is generally a table. And the interruption model is just, it's a matrix. You know, I built it in Excel when I started out with it. So there's a lot of that. When we talk about sort of visually focused diagrams, when we're translating these experiences into something you can hand off, flows are a really important part of that process, especially when we're talking about multimodal experiences over time. And so I talk about sort of multimodal flows or triple flows. They resemble very much swim lane diagrams, if you are familiar with that. Usually, like one approach to this visualization that I'm fond of right now is sort of a five-lane diagram where the system state is in the middle, the input states are on the top. There's two columns, one for input, one for output, and the output states are on the bottom, one on the bottom, one on the top. And so you kind of walk through a scenario that way. And so that's a way of helping a partner kind of see how the customer moves through the experience over time and how there may be multiple potential states in that experience based on their choices in any given modality. Because the holy grail of these multimodal experiences, and you know, to go back to the Star Trek analogy, is choice. The customer can switch between modalities based on their needs in the moment. If you're forcing the customer to switch between multiple modes, you are multimodal, but you're still excluding a bunch of customers. And in fact, if you're forcing people to move between modes of interaction, like move between haptic touch and voice, now you're excluding both people who can only use touch and people who can only use voice, because your experience requires both. So really, our holy grail is something that lets people use what they need when they need it. Then you don't need a bunch of accessibility adaptations. You don't need a bunch of workarounds. Your experience just lets people be who they need to be in the moment, whether they have a temporary disability or a permanent disability. But that's complicated, and that's why you need diagrams like that. But there's certainly also a lot of tables. Another table that's I walk you through the creation of. If any of you are familiar with the concept of atomic design from Brad Frost, I walk you through the use of Brad's atomic design mental model, the application of that to multimodal design. So that in general was applied to sort of visual design, output and haptic input, but like, how could you extend that to a world that also included like voice input and output? or physical control input and output. So I walk you through that process. And there's an interview with Brad in the book too, where we sort of talk about that experience. And there's a whole chapter about bringing your ideas to life, because this can be challenging for folks who were used to just 2D wireframes. If you're working on mixed reality or virtual reality, talking about some of the techniques that they use for prototyping and brainstorming those experiences, if you're talking about basic storyboarding techniques, if you haven't been in that habit before, because storyboarding is a really important part of this process, not Pixar level storyboarding, and I include some of my own storyboards in there just to help kind of level the playing field, because I did not go to an art school, and I'm a big proponent of doing storyboarding with Sharpies on printer paper, so I don't get precious about it, and I don't like try to get perfectionist. Like, I'm just trying to get the ideas across. If I make a huge mistake, I'll throw the cheap paper away and try again. But otherwise, just draw it and move on. Like, we're just, some of my storyboards are just Sharpies on post-it notes. But some of them are a little bit higher fidelity and like a little colored in, but that's because they went to Jeff Bezos. I want to encourage people to start playing around with that, not because everyone needs to be an artist, but like, there are so many visual thinkers in your stakeholders. And so being able to like get the where of your customer context out and into their heads, out of your head into their heads, without like a 30-minute video edit compilation, is so valuable when you're working on this type of experience. So that's some examples of the types of things you see in that latter half of the book. Lots of tables, some examples of how to transform your flow diagrams to use in this context, and some examples of maybe non-tangible techniques you can use to help get you to these sorts of deliverables.
Give us some real product examples, maybe from your project or built by other teams, that you think are, you know, for example, handling the device handoff really well, and provide good example and inspiration for our listeners.
Well, I will talk through an experience I know well because I worked on it. I'm not going to say that it's perfect. But we can talk about like good and bad of the experience. Like, one of the things that inspired a lot of my thinking was my time working on the Alexa notifications platform. So when I joined the Alexa voice design team, my biggest challenge was designing Alexa notifications. We, at the time I joined the team, she was not capable, or it, depending on how you prefer to refer to the system, was not capable of interrupting you without you starting the interaction. So that was a big challenge. And I think, you know, if we look at the way the system, the way it's manifested today, if you have an Alexa device in your household, what manifests is mostly package notifications, right? So if you order a package from Amazon, what you're going to get is usually like a little chime and a yellow notification light. And then you ask Alexa for more information about what your notifications are, and you get that information there, and then she'll give you that information. She does not, even when you're idle, just talk at you and just say you've got stuff coming. And I have not to this day found a setting that allows me to do that. So that's an intentional choice to, like, even no matter what the customer's activity is, to sort of respect the sanctity of the home. But there's also there's some subtle timing things in there. Like, if there's already an alarm going off, the chime isn't going to play if the notification comes in. There, you know, so that's paying attention to something that's already, you know, an activity the customer's already engaged in. And if you're on a phone call, it shouldn't play the sound. It's just kind of queue up and wait for you to be off the call. Although, hopefully that's still the case. I haven't done a lot of phone calls on the Alexa experience. I think, you know, and the interaction with do not disturb is interesting too, like to talk through like how we dealt with that. You should not ship a notification system without a do not disturb experience, either in the OS or some way for people to say, please don't interrupt me. And it's interesting because, especially once you've got a recurring do not disturb experience, like, how do you kind of let remind people that the device is in a state where they might not be getting all the information that they expect or that they had originally asked for. And the way we handle that right now is, or that they, now that I don't work there, is there's a purple light that comes on when the device moves into do not disturb mode. And then there's a purple light that shows at the end of any interaction you have with the device during do not disturb mode. And that's an interesting choice too, where like the customer's already expressed this desire not to be interrupted with extra sound. So we don't say like, hey, by the way, you're do not disturb mode. And we don't play.
Right? We disturb you by telling you that.
Right. But we had some discussions like, is it appropriate to play a special sound at the end of the interaction? Because you have opened the door to some sound by interacting with it. Like, is it appropriate to like play it? Oh, by the way, you're in do not disturb sound. So those are the kinds of like contextually informed discussions that you should be having. And we don't always get it right. I think I heard a story from someone where their first Alexa package notification came in like at night or something. And it just like scared the first thing in the morning. And so the yellow glowing light just scared the stuff out of them. And like, yeah, okay, well, we should have thought about that. Like, you know, maybe that's a gap in the behavior model that I had put together. Like I had talked, you know, I talk about a set of five behaviors. And there's one that's like passive, but should sleeping or like pre-day stuff really be in the live category, like the do not interrupt me full cognitive, like is there another category for like just cognitively not capable of dealing with the system for do not disturb and for just waking up and that kind of thing? You know, that's an open question because that's a state that we didn't really deal with when I was working on Alexa notifications. You know, that story kind of got back around to me. And, you know, hindsight is certainly 2020. I was like, oh, yeah, I can see how weird random glowing light in the middle of the night would, what is it, launching into space? I don't know. And that's the kind of customer context we need to continue to seek out and to build and to be hungry for. And you can see how that's probably a good example of like what we want is to kind of learn about our customer's full experience. And so we learn about their full day, right? And so that conversation comes up, it gets modeled in the behavior model. We didn't necessarily learn about their whole day, so we didn't talk about what happens before they really have the first cup of coffee. It didn't get modeled in the behavior model. So we didn't talk about what happens when you interrupt them before the first cup of coffee, which meant that we could get into a situation where we had an inappropriate interruption, even though like it's just a little sound and a light. Just a little sound and a light in the wrong situation can be really alarming, like a dark room. and when it does that, it didn't necessarily tell them what it was for at that time, I don't think, or like how you could retrieve the notification for some reason. I think because it was so early, it didn't explain itself. You're like, oh, awkward. Yeah. So that's one example, like to like full transparency, like both. I think it does a good job of and compared to some devices, it's not really intrusive. When it's like during the day, it's just a sound and a little light, and you know you can turn it off if you don't want package notifications. The other thing we also did a really intentional job of is it doesn't stack. So if you get a package notification where it says, "Hey, a package is coming," and the package shows up, we replace the package notification. We don't set now you don't have two notifications where it's like the package is coming, the package is here. It's just the package is here. That was a very intentional choice. We had to discuss that with our product partners. And that's another important point I think that I try to make multiple times around the book. When you're operating at this level of complexity, these conversations need to happen early in the process. Like that's an easy design decision to make before the notification system is implemented. And, you know, they did it and it works and it's in the Alexa notification system. But if I had come to them after the fact and said like, oh, by the way, I need all the notifications for a single package to be linked so that you only have one at a time, that's a big change. So you want to have your vision early so that you can all work together and save yourself that pain. But at the same time, we didn't necessarily account for all the behaviors that our customers might have. And some awkward experiences came out of that.
This designing, you know, notifications, it's a whole, I think it requires like whole episode of its own, because literally it's such delicate art indeed. Because as a founder of Usalist, we've worked so hard on our in-app notifications for people inside their SaaS products. And the questions that you've been raising just in those few minutes before, we ask them as well. And I'm sure every software engineer should be asking those questions, because we do have notifications as part of how software works. So let's not dive in there further, but yeah, that is definitely giant topic. I'm wondering if that interruption is always about notifications, or is there anything else that can be called an interruption that we should be thinking about? So I imagine we can design an activity model for software, you know, figure out different modes of the users doing something. But what are the interruptions except for, you know, those notifications?
It's an interesting and subtle point, and I agree with you about notifications. I've worked on several systems myself. There's a whole chapter in the book about them, about interruptions in general. And we can't even agree on what the term is, right? Like notifications, alerts, like what? Between platforms, nobody agrees. But I really love the interview in the proactivity chapter with Anna Abobian, who's a user experience design lead. I think she's recently maybe been promoted, but at 3M, working on healthcare applications of this sort of technology. And she likes to talk about how, like, if we can avoid using notifications, that would be great. And how maybe we should really look at things more like nudges. And nudges are a little bit more like, you know, even the example I gave for the Alexa system is maybe a little bit much for nudges, but it was close. And so she talks through extremely complicated scenarios where you've got like doctors doing medical transcription and they've got AI that has ideas about potential comorbidities or things that maybe that doctor should look at, but they don't want the system to replace the doctor's knowledge, right? The doctor may come to those conclusions on their own, and the system may not have all the context yet. And so they have like very subtle systems where like lights or sounds will light up when the system has something for the doctor, but in a very non-interruptive way. And that's those are the nudges. And, you know, in some ways, the badges on your phone could be, you could argue that those are nudges. The numbers make, if you have the numbers in the circles, to me, that makes them more notifications. But if you just had like a little dot that says there's something, that's more of a nudge. If I have a dot that says I have 200 messages, that's a notification. That's a strong call to action, but just a little badge. Maybe more of a nudge, but there's these subtle asks to go to a certain place, and then there's calls to action. And I think notifications, alerts are more calls to action. And then we've been also overloading, I think, the concept of notifications, which to me should be an event has occurred that requires your attention, and we use it for marketing. Right? Like we just fire things up and are like, hey, did you know about this? Like this feature exists, which is not, that's not an event if the feature has existed for a while. And it often gets used that way. It's one thing if a new feature shows up, but I've seen this sort of abuse of notifications occurred all the time. Or, hey, did you know our app exists? Remember that our app exists. Please come love us. That sort of notification. I think And so I talk a bit too in one of the challenges for multimodal systems, especially those that deal with invisible interaction modalities like voice, discoverability is a huge challenge. Like you can't rely on putting a clickable button up there and people finding it. And yeah, it is tough. And are nudges the right way to get people to discover that there's features they're not using? Are there sort of other ways you can help people find stuff? Is there a way to do verbal nudging, or is that too forward to call it a nudge? Like, I don't know if you've ever noticed with Alexa, but she will sometimes now follow on with certain interactions with a suggestion for a related feature. I think the feature, the way it's implemented is not the way I had hoped we would implement it. It doesn't, it's great because it does, you know, you ask her for the weather. She's like, I can give you, did you know I can give you the weather for the whole weekend? Do you want that? The thing is, she often suggests the same thing even after I've already asked for it once or twice. Like, I know we've done that. Shush, stop. So I talked a little bit about discoverability and how like that kind of opportunistic nudging or follow-on opportunity is great if it's paired with tracking or awareness of what the customer actually needs to learn. And so that's, I think that's an important part. So when we back the conversation up, we talk about proactivity in general. Right now, our industry just sort of puts that all into the notifications bucket. But there's a lot of subtlety that can be sort of unrolled from that bucket. There's actual event-based notifications. There's sort of the marketing side of things, like, hey, please remember that this thing exists. There's discoverability, like helping people learn about a particular feature or an app. And then there's the nudging, like, hey, the AI has some stuff for you, but we don't want to get in the way and remove your human agency. So we're just going to make it easier or for you to go in a certain direction. Or we're going to make it evident that there's stuff for you in a certain direction without making it overwhelming. So there's a couple of different philosophies there that we don't always employ.
There is one little question. I know we're going deeply over time there, but I'm sure a lot of listeners tuned into this episode title hoping to get, you know, recommendations on how to better prepare for like cross-device handoff, like switching in their more, you know, more everyday projects. So do you have any brief recommendations for those listeners?
Well, one thing that I think, and hopefully you're already having these conversations, but one conversation to have if you're not is what data needs to be handed off between these devices. Having a good understanding about kind of like what that, both the user profile and the session profile, and making sure that's represented separately from the user interface model. So, you know, it's not represented in the code for the smart speaker UI or the HTML, but it's represented at another layer that's accessible by both of those interfaces is really important. Otherwise, you know, there's a pretty big point of failure there. And so that's one conversation that if you haven't had it already, start having that, because even just that change could take a while and will help you a lot. Because once you move that data up a level and make it accessible to those two devices, it's accessible by a bunch of different devices. You've suddenly totally broadened your span of influence. And then if some other weird device shows up tomorrow, that can access that session data too. And you future-proofed yourself. So instead of just like hacking it so the smart speaker can talk directly to the, you know, to the website that they were interacting with, finding ways to just level up and think about your sessions at a different level than the devices they're interacting on, super important. The other thing to think about is really understanding, if you haven't done journey mapping or looked into journey mapping, if you can't say at least one reason why someone might move between the desktop and the phone on your site, it's a good exercise to ask. There's probably at least one field, one form, or one page on your site that might motivate someone to switch. It could be a data entry field that's just easier for someone to do with voice and they like doing that on their phone better. It could be that there's just something that doesn't scale down to the phone well and so they might want to go to the desktop. But understanding the motivation behind transitions is really important, and that can, you know, it's hard to have a conversation about we should work more on our cross-device experiences without knowing the why. Like, and so starting with the why, like, okay, we have these hypotheses that customers move back and forth between devices, and here's here's what they are, that's a good place to start. Obviously, customer context, if you can get actual data about that, that's great. But starting with a little bit of like, hey, let's just do some sort of expert assessment and see where we think there might be this potential need or interest in bouncing back and forth between devices or modalities. Like, where might people on your site already be dropping to voice, and what opportunities might that open up for you? Or when might they really want to use a smart speaker, and what might opportunity might that open up for you?
This is super helpful. Thanks so much, Cheryl, for sharing your wisdom with us today. Where can people find you and your work online?
Well, a couple of good places. If you want to find out about my design education work, which includes my workshops, talks, and sometimes different articles and things like that, ideaplats.com is a great place to go. And I also have a Medium sort of page for both Ideaplats and myself, Cheryl Platts. I do have a personal website, CherylPlatts.com, if you want to learn more about like my improv stuff and sort of like the broader expanse of my work, and find my social media accounts. I have many. Social media accounts are generally under IdeaPlatts on Twitter, and then Funny Godmother on most social media platforms that have been created, from Twitter to TikTok and Instagram and all the things. And then, of course, Design Beyond Devices, Creating Multimodal Cross-Device Experiences is available from Rosenfeld Media in paperback and digital, both regular digital and Kindle. And so you can buy it from the Rosenfeld Media website or your country's Amazon affiliate. If you're listening to this in sort of real time, I do have several workshops that I'm offering in February. So check out the IdeaPlatts website to learn more about those.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Cheryl. And wishing you good luck with the book promotion 2021 and all your future deeds.
Thank you so much for the great conversation and questions, Jane. And thank you for having me here.
Wonderful. Please enjoy the rest of your week.
Bye, everybody.